The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com. Writer's strike poised to end as WGA and studios reach a tentative agreement. This article was written by Natalie Jarvie, and there is a note. This story originally appeared in Vanity Fair. It took 146 days and multiple marathon negotiating sessions attended by CEOs, including Bob Iger and David Zaslav, but the Hollywood writers' strike appears poised to end. On Sunday night, the Writers Guild of America said it had reached a tentative deal for a new contract, signaling that writers could soon pack up their picket signs and return to work after a nearly five-month walkout. In an email to members, the WGA Negotiating Committee said they are still working to draft final contract language and that they would send more details soon. "We can say with great pride that this deal is exceptional, with meaningful gains and protections for writers in every sector of the membership," it reads. Once the contract is finalized, the negotiating committee will vote on whether to send it on to WGA leadership for approval. Then, the guild's more than 11,000 members will be asked to vote to ratify the deal. Writers called their first strike in over a decade after walking away from contract negotiations with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers on May 1st. The guild framed the strike as the answer to an existential crisis facing writers who had watched as streaming eroded the working conditions and pay structures that once propped up the industry. "The company's behavior has created a gig economy inside a union workforce, and their immovable stance in this negotiation has betrayed a commitment to further devaluing the profession of writing," the WGA said in a statement announcing the work stoppage. The strike, which began the next day, sent the industry into a tailspin. Late-night shows like The Tonight Show and Saturday Night Live immediately halted production. Writers' rooms for popular TV shows, including Abbott Elementary and Yellowjackets, disbanded. The screenwriter for Marvel's upcoming Blade reboot stopped sending in drafts. In mid-July, more than 160,000 actors and performers joined writers on the picket lines when their guild, SAG-AFTRA, also declared a strike. The first double strike in more than 60 years brought Hollywood to its knees, effectively ending all production that had continued during the writers' work stoppage. Because of the labor action, the Television Academy postponed the Emmys. The studios moved release dates for high-profile movies, including Dune Part 2, and the broadcast networks stocked all their fall TV schedules with reality shows, football, and reruns. After a 92-day stalemate, the WGA and AMPTP resumed negotiations in August, but made little progress. A counteroffer from the AMPTP included concessions on some key issues, including AI protections, but the WGA said those weren't nearly enough. Top CEOs attempted to meet with members of the guild, but the face-to-face didn't go well either. And after the AMPTP publicly released its counteroffer, talks stalled. Many industry insiders hoped to find a resolution to the strikes before Labor Day, a symbolic nadir in the ongoing fight because it's when many top executives and creatives return from the Hamptons or the Mediterranean and expect to dig back into work. But the holiday weekend came and went without a deal. The start of fall has brought with it a renewed determination on both sides to stop the strike. On Wednesday, September 20th, the WGA and AMPTP met for the first time in nearly a month. Notably, sources tell Vanity Fair that leaders from four of the major studios were present for the meeting, a rarity during labor bargaining sessions. The leaders, Iger, Zaslav, Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos and NBC Universal Studio Group Chairman Donna Langley participated in a marathon sit-down with the hope of hammering out a workable deal, returning Thursday and Friday to continue negotiating. Ahead of the meeting, a studio side source expressed optimism about reaching an agreement. People are feeling the economic pressure and the realities of how long this has gone on. It's impacting everyone, from the biggest corporations to the hairstylists to the restaurants. There's a shared desire to get back to work, the source added. WGA members showed up in droves to the picket lines on Friday after a Thursday evening email from guild leaders thanked them for all the messages of solidarity and support we have received from the last few days, and requested as many of you as possible to come out to the picket lines tomorrow. Strike captains extended picketing outside many studios on Friday. The day ended without a deal, but negotiators agreed to meet again on Sunday and Saturday. Reaching a deal is the hardest step in these negotiations, but the strike isn't over quite yet. Though the WGA is suspending picketing and encouraging writers to support SAG-AFTRA on the picket lines, the negotiating committee wrote in its member email, "No one is to return to work until specifically authorized by the guild." The WGA must now finalize its contract. As soon as Tuesday, the leadership groups at both the East and West branches of the WGA will then vote to send the contract to members for ratification. At that time, leadership will also vote on whether to allow writers to return to work while the official ratification is pending. But even if the writers' strike ends this week, Hollywood won't be back to business as usual until the AMPTP hammers out a deal with SAG-AFTRA. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Senator Dianne Feinstein dies at 90. And this article was written by Lexi McMenamin. Dianne Feinstein, the nation's longest-serving woman senator and the state of California's longest-serving senator, has died at age 90. Feinstein served in public office for over 50 years. Before ascending to the Senate, she was San Francisco's first woman mayor and first woman president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. A White House press statement from earlier this year noted that Feinstein was elected to the Senate in 1992, deemed the Woman of the Year, in part due to her election. Her legislative legacy was defined by her commitment to gun control legislation and her centrist approach to working across the aisle, occasionally raising the furor of her party members and causing clashes with young progressives. Feinstein's first mayoral appointment was incited by gun violence. She took office in 1978 following the assassination of then-Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk, then on the city's Board of Supervisors. As mayor of San Francisco, she was praised for putting more funding toward addressing the AIDS epidemic in the city than the entire federal government at the time. In 1994, as a senator, Feinstein authored and helped pass a federal assault weapons ban. After its expiration in 2004, she continued lobbying for stricter gun control. As chairperson of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the first woman appointed in 2009 to the post, she oversaw a five-year investigation into the CIA's torture practices under the Bush administration and pushed for the report to be declassified. "It's my very strong belief that one day this report should be declassified," she said. "This must be a lesson learned, that torture doesn't work." Alternatively, Feinstein could be hawkish, as the Associated Press noted. She supported President Obama's wide-ranging collection of American phone and web data. Feinstein's final years were dogged by scrutiny of her ability to serve in office as not only the Senate's oldest member, but also with increasing headlines about her failing health. In February, shortly before she was hospitalized for shingles, Feinstein announced her intention to retire at the end of her current term, January 2025.
She was then absent from the Senate for about 3 months, related to her shingles hospitalization, which heightened concerns around her fitness to serve. In recent weeks, reporters had zeroed in on a Feinstein family dispute, suggesting that Feinstein was largely removed from the day-to-day goings-on, echoing reports on her current approach to office. Such reporting had led to calls for Feinstein to step down from office, which she refused to do. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced a few weeks ago that he would appoint an interim replacement to Feinstein's seat if it became vacant early, though it would not be either of the three high-profile Democrats already campaigning for her seat, Representatives Barbara Lee, Katie Porter, and Adam Schiff. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Three things to do if you can't stop thinking about that thing you said. This article was written by Catherine Keller, and there is a note. This article first appeared on self.com. The night I said, "I've heard it's actually good for you," to explain, read, lie about, why I started chomping on the 100% not edible soybean pod when trying edamame for the first time at a fancy fusion restaurant in NYC. That time I immediately, without thinking about the lyrics, started singing, "I don't see nothing wrong with a little bump and grind," after a coworker and I agreed we'd never be able to listen to R. Kelly again in light of his sexual abuse charges. I'm a survivor myself of all the songs to burst out with. The handful of misused words or sayings I've texted, emailed, or shudder, said aloud in my lifetime. These are just a few of the many, many, many "I can't believe I said that" moments that have haunted me. I know, none of those missteps are a big deal, nor are they evidence that I'm a bad, unintelligent, or otherwise unworthy person. To err and say dumb stuff is human, so I deserve a little self-love. I'm happy to report that I know that now I'm much less hard on myself in my 30s than I was in my teens and 20s. But I'd be lying if I said I never dwell on my verbal blunders. My heart rate ticked up a bit just from publicly sharing the "doh" moments above. Knowing that it's okay to make mistakes and feeling that are two very different things. If you, too, sometimes find yourself face-palming over a poor choice of words or lying awake at night replaying that incredibly goofy slash insensitive slash embarrassing thing you can't believe you said in your mind, I'm here to offer us both some relief. I reached out to Katerina Y. Strategis, PSYD, a clinical psychologist at Thrive Psychology Group in New York City, who specializes in perfectionism and shame, to get some practical advice for letting yourself off the hook so you can get on with your life. Break free from your critical thoughts with cognitive diffusion. One reason we might get fixated on a self-critical thought is because we believe it is universally true, Dr. Strategis tells Self. By reminding yourself that it's simply something your brain is creating, not a fact, it often becomes easier to cope with. This skill of noticing thoughts for what they are, rather than getting caught up in them, is known as cognitive diffusion, she explains. For example, let's say you can't stop obsessing over calling your boss's boss mom. You might be thinking things like, "I am so stupid. I'm embarrassed." Or, "I can't go back to work tomorrow." Using such definitive words as "I am" and "I can't" doesn't leave you with much wiggle room to challenge them, Dr. Strategis says. Cognitive diffusion might look like reframing those notions as, "I'm having the thought of I'm stupid," "I'm experiencing the emotion of embarrassment," or "I'm having the thought that I don't want to show my face in the office again." By separating yourself from your thoughts and feelings by one degree, you don't automatically accept them as fact, making them a lot easier to challenge and cope with, she explains. Another form of cognitive diffusion is using imagery to get some distance from your self-criticism, she adds. For example, you can try the leaves on a stream exercise, a tool sometimes used in acceptance and commitment therapy, which involves sitting in a comfortable position, closing your eyes, or focusing on a fixed spot in the room, and picturing yourself placing each thought that pops in your head on a leaf and letting it float down, yep, a stream. Again, the idea is to disconnect from your stream, ha, of thinking, so you're not, immersed in it. Practice self-compassion. If the idea of being kinder to yourself is eliciting an eye roll, know this. It really can help you stop ruminating about your perceived slip-ups, according to Dr. Strategis. When you can't stop thinking about that thing you said, exercise self-compassion by trying not to judge yourself so harshly, she recommends. Recognize that you are a human who makes mistakes, and that's normal and okay. If giving yourself a break isn't exactly your strong suit, why, hello. You can try some of these practical ways to practice self-compassion, including a Dr. Strategis favorite. Ask yourself, what would I tell a friend if they came to me with this? We'll go ahead and assume you wouldn't relentlessly berate them. In my opinion, self-compassion is the most important skill one can learn, Dr. Strategis says. By having a more compassionate worldview, you live with less shame and anxiety, which leads to a more peaceful and fulfilling life. Sold. Write out your thoughts, but do it strategically. What? You thought you were going to get out of here without a journaling exercise? Don't worry. This one is super simple. Realistically, no one remembers that time in third grade when you tripped in front of the whole class, Dr. Strategis says. The reason it is so memorable is because it caused an intense response within you. We are more likely to remember events that have a strong emotional reaction connected to them. One of the best ways to cope with a repetitive thought or memory is to address the emotional response and beliefs it brings up, she says. And writing down what you're thinking and feeling is a good way to do that. However, you don't want to fall into the trap of journaling with no limits, Dr. Strategis warns, since that could prolong your rumination. Instead, she recommends setting a timer for 2 minutes and jotting down whatever comes up when you think about the regrettable thing you said. When the timer runs out, ask yourself, has this been helpful? If so, you can set another 2-minute timer and continue writing out your thoughts and feelings. Keep doing this until you've reached a natural stopping point, she says, or you find yourself repeating the same stuff. The purpose behind journaling is to help you process the emotions behind the thoughts that you're stuck on. Embarrassment, shame, or disappointment, for example, Dr. Strategis explains. By putting those thoughts and emotions out of your mind and onto paper, you're essentially storing them in a tangible place, which can make it easier to move on. In other words, it can get you, and that thing you said, out of your head. And our next article from TeenVogue.com. Amazon sued by FTC 17 states over monopoly practices. And this article was written by Lexi McMenamin. Amazon is being sued by the Federal Trade Commission and 17 state attorneys general over allegations of monopolistic practices in a lawsuit filed in Western Washington state. NPR summarizes the complaints about Amazon as spurred by it owning not only the online platform that many sellers use to reach shoppers, while also owning the related shipping and delivery services and still selling its own products on that very same platform. The lawsuit accuses Amazon of unfair methods of competition towards both consumers and third-party retailers that sell on its platform, alleging that Amazon has seized control over much of the online retail economy by exploiting its monopolies in ways that enrich Amazon but harm its customers. Amazon is accused of prohibiting its third-party retailers from selling at lower prices on other platforms and essentially forcing them to use its shipping services in exchange for placement on Amazon Prime, as reported by the New York Times. The FTC and state AGs say these practices have resulted in artificially higher prices and a worse shopping experience for consumers, per the Times. Amazon's Senior Vice President of Global Public Policy and General Counsel, David Sapolsky, said the FTC lawsuit would have the opposite of its intended effects and claimed it was wrong on the facts and the law. Jackie Germain, former fellow at Teen Vogue, explained that the FTC enforces consumer protections, guards against predatory business practices, and ensures fair market competition, which includes enforcing antitrust regulations on monopolistic companies. To put it plainly, we use the term monopoly to refer to corporations with excess unchecked private power over our lives, Becky Chow, director of anti-monopoly at the Economic Security Project, told Germain in 2021. FTC Chair Lina Khan said the complaint accuses the country's most popular online store of unlawfully maintaining its monopolies by using a set of punitive and coercive tactics, per Ars Technica. The complaint sets forth detailed allegations, noting how Amazon is now exploiting its monopoly power to enrich itself, while raising prices and degrading services for the tens of millions of American families who shop on its platform, and the hundreds of thousands of businesses that rely on Amazon to reach them, said Khan. The 17 states party to the lawsuit are Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Nevada, New York, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Olivia Rodrigo and Sheryl Crow perform If It Makes You Happy in Nashville. And this article was written by Ashley Carter. Olivia Rodrigo shared the stage with another musical legend for an intimate performance in Nashville this week. The Guts artist shared an Instagram post on Friday with musician Sheryl Crow, 61, at the famous Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. In a photo, Rodrigo and Crow are shown sitting in salon chairs, each reading various copies of Vogue magazine. Crow was holding Vogue's August 2023 issue, with Rodrigo on the cover. The pair did more than just spend time together reading. They also sang together in front of the intimate crowd. Rodrigo joined Crow in singing her 1996 hit song, If It Makes You Happy. The duo harmonized perfectly as Crow played the song on acoustic guitar. Pinch Me sang one of my greatest songs of all time with the greatest of all time, Sheryl Crow, Rodrigo wrote in the caption. What an honor! Crow also shared Rodrigo's Instagram post, adding to the caption, Funnest day ever with the amazingly brilliant at Olivia Rodrigo. What a talent! And the loveliest young woman! Rodrigo also shared a selfie on Instagram stories while geotagging Nashville, along with rows of cowboy boots. Crow presented Rodrigo with Billboard's Woman of the Year Award in 2022 and gave a moving speech about the young singer's artistry, saying that Rodrigo is going to be around for a very long time. As Rodrigo's evolved, she's captured the attention of audiences of all ages with her honest lyrics, Crow said during the award speech. And whether you're a teenager living through it right now, or she's taking you down memory lane, her songs have a visceral power to them that touches your core. In Rodrigo's acceptance speech, she fangirled over Crow, saying she is such a massive fan. "I'm so grateful that you're here. It really means the world," Rodrigo added. Rodrigo is celebrating the release of her sophomore album, Guts, which was instantly met with critical and commercial success. The singer and songwriter announced earlier this month that she would be going on tour starting in February 2024. And our next article from TeenVogue.com. Are Keke Palmer and Darius Jackson still together? Mind y'all's business, she says. And this article was written by Sarah Delgado. If Keke Palmer and Darius Jackson had to declare their relationship on Facebook, the status would 100% be "it's complicated," and Palmer has no intention of clarifying things anytime soon. On September 25th, Keke Palmer stopped by Today with Hoda and Jenna after months of drama, was asked about the status of her relationship with Jackson, with whom she shares her first son, Leotis Andrelton Jackson. Let's just say she was a bit, guarded. "Not y'all trying to get into it. They trying it on the Today Show," Palmer quipped after the hosts posed their question. Palmer went on to say that life is good and that she has nothing but gratitude at the moment. When she was asked to specify what that meant for her relationship with Jackson, Palmer shut down all inquiries. "I'm not trying to be specific," she said before adding, "I'm going to take a page out of my girl Beyoncé's book. Mind y'all's business." Okay. After welcoming their first child in February, the couple made headlines earlier this summer when Jackson publicly shamed Palmer's sartorial choice while attending one of Usher's Vegas residency concerts. "It's the outfit, though. You a mom," Jackson tweeted in July, referring to Palmer's sheer number. Following the incident, Palmer took the chance to shout out her maternal status any chance she got, even selling merch that read, "I'm a mother." She later also starred in the music video for Usher's single Boyfriend, acting in a narrative seemingly inspired by her experience at the artist's Vegas residency and all the drama that ensued after. Though neither Palmer nor Jackson ever announced their relationship had come to an end, many online assumed their actions post-feud meant they had broken up. But surprise, surprise, it seems like that was not necessarily the case. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.